Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast. I'm Doug Krisner. You can join Brian Curtis and myself for the stories making news and moving markets in the APAC region. You can subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcast and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Well, China's BYD has reported annual profit that missed analyst estimates. Bloomberg's Joanne Wong has the story from Hong Kong.
Net income for 2023 was $4.16 billion. That compares to an estimate of $4.29 billion. BYD sold just over 3 million electric and hybrid vehicles last year. It overtook Tesla in the final quarter of 2023 as the world's biggest seller of EVs. But it may struggle to hold the title early this year. That's due to seasonal factors tied to the Lunar New Year holiday. In addition, BYD has kicked off a second round of price cuts. It has discounted most of its product range as it seeks to convince drivers to switch from gas-guzzling cars to EVs. In Hong Kong, I'm Joanne Wong, Bloomberg Radio.
All right, it's 8 minutes past the hour. For a little further discussion on BYD, we're joined by Linda Liu, who is Bloomberg's China cars reporter. So these earnings, you know, weren't great, but they weren't too bad. BYD reporting net income for the full year that came in the middle of the forecast range. As you look at these numbers, what stands out the most? I mean, the price war, I guess, is dominating, right?
Yeah, I guess to take things into perspective, BYD's profits did break record for the company. You know, it managed to sell also another record-breaking 3 million vehicles last year. So overall, it is doing well, but obviously analysts have higher expectations for the company. And the bottom line has been impacted by the price war, which BYD is intensifying, discounting many of its popular models since late last year and continuing well into this year.
So when you look at a company like Tesla, to what extent is Tesla being impacted by the way in which BYD is doing business in China?
Tesla, even though, you know, they're quite a special brand, and a lot of the electric vehicle buyers in China, they've not been able to escape the impact from the price war. Our Bloomberg colleagues have reported that Tesla actually started to trim its production output in its Shanghai plant. So it shows that they are also experiencing a weakening demand from this really fierce EV market in China.
What a lot of investors might be curious about is whether or not they get too far out over their skis with some of these global expansion plans. I'm not sure whether or not they added much, and I know that there's a call this morning from which we'll probably get a lot more questions answered. But anything in these earnings that stand out with the thinking about setting up a plant in Mexico and expanding in Europe and ultimately trying to get into the U.S. market?
Yeah, BYD is definitely going to continue its international expansion because, you know, although China is the world's largest EV market, given this fierce price war that's happening, the margins from cars sold in China actually isn't as high as BYD would like to hope. So by exporting to overseas markets like Europe, they can actually command higher pricing, and that in turn can help lift their bottom line. And it was noted by analysts that their margins wasn't actually as bad as expected, maybe from some of this effect of exporting overseas and having higher pricing for those cars.
I was looking at the FT. They had an article in the most recent edition, the digital edition, talking about how about a quarter, 25% of the EVs sold in the European Union this year will be manufactured in China. This is creating a bit of tension with the companies in, particularly in Germany, that manufacture vehicles. Is there a way out? Is there a way to kind of dial down the tension and perhaps a lot more of it?
That's a really good question. It's not very clear how this tension can be kind of alleviated because China right now is experiencing this problem of weakening demand and overcapacity. So a lot of these automakers kind of have nowhere to go but to export their vehicles. But on the other hand, you see in Europe, with these new, probably cheaper vehicles coming into their market, that's going to hit the local automakers. So like you said, the firms in Germany probably aren't very happy with this. And we know the French have also lobbied the EU to kind of launch this anti-subsidy investigation. So it remains to be seen how China is going to have to manage these geopolitics. And I think with this coming year, when the results of the anti-subsidy investigation comes out, we're going to have a clearer picture.
I think we have to say, with BYD now offering its most inexpensive car at less than $10,000 US, and with this price war that we've seen, they're going for volume here. And this must really spook some of the other automakers in China, particularly, as Doug mentioned at the beginning, Tesla.
Precisely. After BYD kind of kicked off this latest round of price cuts in the beginning of this year, we've seen other car makers followed, includes brands like Geely, Leapmotor. A lot of EV makers kind of have no choice but to follow. And the interesting thing is these price cuts have also impacted gasoline vehicles, which can, usually are cheaper than EVs. But now BYD has this goal of making EVs cheaper than gasoline cars. So that's forced companies like Toyota and Volkswagen to kind of have to join in and try to counter this offensive.
Yeah, we were talking earlier in the program about this move on the part of China to file a complaint, essentially, with the World Trade Organization over some of the EV subsidies that exist here in the States as the result of the Inflation Reduction Act, one of the president's signature pieces of legislation. And his trade rep, Catherine Tsai, saying, basically holding up the mirror to Beijing and saying that China continues to use unfair policies and practices to undermine fair competition and dominate global markets. It doesn't sound like free trade without protectionism is going to continue to exist when you look at the electric vehicle industry.
No, definitely not. I think this follows this greater trend of deglobalization, basically countries kind of erecting these barriers up again to protect their domestic industries that may have been dismantled decades ago, especially since China joined the WTO. And I think the U.S. Has a fair point in that China did install quite a lot of rules to protect its auto industry, especially in its kind of growing up phase. When foreign automakers entered the Chinese market, they weren't able to do so without forming a joint venture where they cannot own more than 50% of that business. So essentially having to kind of share profits and technology with a local Chinese partner. And in that process, the Chinese domestic car makers, you know, got to benefit from these know-how of the foreign car makers. So now the table kind of has turned. And so, I think it will be really interesting to watch how these kind of trade tensions will continue to unfold.
Yeah, I was struck by the irony in the answers to one of the earlier questions where you said BYD, you know, it's not making as much money in China as it would like because it has to sell the cars too cheap and it can sell them at higher prices in Europe. But then the European car makers are worried that those prices are too low for Europe. So it's quite ironic. And then it raises the question, you know, why is BYD expanding in Japan? I mean, this would seem to be almost like a bottomless pit, but they are very ambitious and they are expanding in Japan. What's the ultimate strategy there?
BYD does seem to have a very global kind of expansion in mind right now. You know, kind of no market would be off limits, I would say. It depends on, you know, how they plan to continue to go into new markets. So Japan definitely is an interesting case, given that it has such an established auto market already. It already has, you know, some of the world's biggest automakers like Toyota. And the Japanese consumers actually don't take to EVs, haven't taken to EVs yet. Hybrids are still selling really well over there. And that's something that BYD doesn't have a strong offering of. BYD probably has a lot of tough time ahead of it, trying to educate the local consumers about EVs and get them to kind of take on as products. But I think if BYD can crack the Japanese market, then that's all the more beneficial for BYD as it continues to expand.
Last question. I'll give you 20 seconds to answer it, Linda. I mean, are you expecting a lot in the way of failures here? Are some of these smaller EV makers in China, just given the macro that we've just laid out, you've done a beautiful job of helping us understand what's at work here. Are we going to expect bankruptcies and failures now at some of these smaller EV makers?
Short answer is yes. We're already seeing quite a few players are pushed to the brink by such a fierce competition, and I think we're going to continue to see more of that.
You know, Doug, we often hear great question from our guests, but we don't often say great answer. But we should say to Linda,
right,
great answers there. You really filled out the scene quite nicely for us. Linda, thank you for joining us. Linda Liu, Bloomberg China Cars reporter with us live. This is Bloomberg.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Let's pick up on a story that Doug mentioned a few moments ago. Alibaba has called off its IPO for its logistics arm, Cainiao. And joining us now in our studios is Sarah Jung, who is Bloomberg China technology reporter. Sarah, this speaks to many issues, but two really come to the fore. One, it's not a very good environment, I guess, for selling assets. So we heard that from Joseph Tsai, that the market is pretty depressed. And secondly, that this kind of brings into question the whole restructuring of Alibaba. What else stands out?
I think that's exactly right. So Joseph Tsai last night in a call with analysts was trying to explain their move. He was saying that, one, it's the pretty depressed market. They can't get the kind of valuation that they believe Cainiao should be strategically valued at. And the other is that they're trying to say that they, because of their focus on their core businesses, which is e-commerce and cloud computing, they want to better expand Cainiao internationally to be able to service their core e-commerce business so that they can compete better in what's a very intensive and highly competitive market.
So this is the second time that Baba has nixed a high-profile debut. Take me back to when the plan to split into six separate units was unveiled. I'm trying to remember that this really was to try to appease the government in some way so that Baba's assets were not so concentrated and they wanted to try to diversify that. Am I remembering that correctly?
Well, that the company itself would probably dispute that, but yes, they did announce this restructuring spinoff plan earlier last year, and part of that, analysts were saying, was to allow the business, which had gotten a little bit too big for its britches, in terms of from the government's perspective, to lay a little bit more low profile and to be able to spin off independently. Of course, since then, in the past few months, we've seen a lot of hiccups in the restructuring process. Last November, Alibaba also nixing the debut for their cloud arm. We saw a lot of leadership reshuffling and shakeups, their longtime CEO, Daniel Zhang, being sort of stepping down quite abruptly and having new leadership come on, including Zhou Tai and also the new CEO, Eddie Wu. And then now Eddie Wu taking the helm directly of cloud and commerce and really restructuring and mixing things up in those units.
It looks on the surface a little bit like disarray. disarray. And investors are obviously, you know, they're selling down the stock a little bit today. But there could be some positives to it. And we still don't know. I mean, they pull Freshippo and they pull now Cainiao. But do we know much about what's ahead for Alibaba Cloud? Because that's one that a lot of investors would have been very interested in.
Exactly. I think Alibaba Cloud was the big high-profile IPO spinoff that everyone was excited for. It seems like now, given market conditions and the rationale into their decision to pull back on Cainiao and also Freshippo, it seems like that's not going to happen now or in the foreseeable future. And so definitely that's something that investors would give pause to them. And Joe actually last night was quite explicit in saying that their original conception of this avenue where they could unlock shareholder value through the capital markets, that's no longer viable, at least in the short term. And now they're going to focus on just trying to drive value through things like buybacks and selling off their non-core business assets and just focusing in on commerce and cloud.
Well, that was part of my next question. When I think of this company, I think of e-commerce, obviously the major player in China. How is that business doing?
Well, they're under a lot of pressure domestically from other rivals, including upstarts like ByteDance with their Douyin, which is the Chinese equivalent of TikTok, and also other short video platforms like Kuaishou, really getting into live streaming e-commerce, which is eating into Alibaba's market share. And also, of course, from their traditional rivals like JD.com and also Pinduoduo, which is more of like a budget type of e-commerce platform. And then internationally, we're also seeing they're under pressure from Pinduoduo's Temu, Shein, also TikTok Shop abroad. So it's really, putting a lot of pressure on the commerce side to perform better. And that's part of why they're saying they want to double down their investment on Cainiao so that they can better service the logistics part of this commerce business.
We know that the chairman, Joseph Tsai, is a very good operator, very sensible and strong operator. And Jack Ma obviously is a legend. They always, in all the conferences that I went to over the 30-odd years here, I mean, the Alibaba people were always among the smartest in the room. So it's hard to imagine what's happened to this company. And it's also hard to bet against in a big way. But it seems like they're in trouble.
I think that's the confusing part or difficult part for a lot of investors to understand. When they initially announced the spinoff plan last year and the restructuring, there was a lot of promise from the investor side. They did feel like, okay, maybe this is a way where this sort of struggling e-commerce empire coming off of the regulatory crackdown from the government, that would be a way that they can reinvigorate growth and unlock that kind of shareholder value. Unfortunately, we haven't really seen that play out in the same way. Part of that is from external factors like just the increasing competition in the market and also just the depressed IPO market, which makes capital markets not a very good path for the company. But at the same time, it does start to raise questions about like what is the management thinking exactly? Were there certain missteps or things they could have done differently in the rollout of this restructuring?
Or is the political pressure just that great? And we don't know. It's almost impossible to say. Everything on that level is kind of black box stuff in China. But we have seen Jack Ma come a little bit more into the spotlight. So it's a story that continues to unfold. Sarah, thanks for helping us understand it. Sarah Cheng, Bloomberg China technology reporter.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
We thought it was a good time to take a closer look at the banks as earnings are nigh in China. Bloomberg Intelligence says that ICBC's margin and loan quality in 2023 in the results could set the tone for the industry's fundamental prospects. And joining us now in our studios is Xujin Chen, who's head of China Financial and Property Research over at Jefferies. So is that right, Xujin, that we could see some margin pressures here for the leading banks in these latest numbers?
Definitely. So for almost all SOE banks, we would probably see around like a 10 basis point decline year on year for last year's margin. And also for like going forward, we still see net interest margin pressure, mainly due to the LPR cut as well as the very weak demand.
So it reflects the interest rate environment. I understand that. And maybe you could make the argument that if loan demand were stronger, it may be okay to sacrifice a little bit of margin. But when I look at the data, at least the numbers for China in the month of February, loan growth was probably the slowest on record, as I recall. So what can the government do? What can anyone do to kind of revive the demand part of the story?
So first, if we only look at February loan growth, it was largely affected by the seasonal issue. You know that last year, the Chinese New Year was in January, and there's no loan issuance during the festival. Well, this year is in February, so that results like very slow loan growth. For the overall loan growth this year, we expect it to slow down a little bit, but the new loan could be like similar amount of last year. On the second is that although the new loan could be like similar to last year's scale, but we think the household demand was quite weak. While banks may like, because they're trying to reach the loan growth target, they may lend to those like central SOE with very low loan yield. So that also, sacrifice their net interest margin. So regarding to like boosting credit demand, I would say that the key focus today is still on the policy side. But because in our base case scenario, we don't expect China to conduct like a bazooka stimulus. Therefore, it could be a long time for those, especially household, to recover demand. For infrastructure and the property sector, we probably will see like more investment following the special government issuance, and also as you know that China is conducting the whitelist for projects, and that helps a little.
That's
bit.
The big thing is with this whitelist, you would expect, I suppose, the banks to be directing a lot more funding in that direction. What does that mean for the others who aren't on the whitelist?
Very good question. So first is that actually, if we look at the rule for the whitelist, one of the key rules is that the project needs to have sufficient collateral. But for China banks, if the projects has sufficient collateral, then banks probably are very happy to lend to it, whether it's on or not on the whitelist. So I think for the projects like outside the whitelist, banks will use their like screening those projects and see whether they have sufficient collateral. But for those on the whitelist, I doubt that they may have some issue regarding to either the like collateral or other issue. If they have sufficient collateral, I don't think the local government need to like push them so hard to banks, right?
We know the real estate story. We know the property prices have been slumping and how that has kind of rippled through the entire economy. The question is, how long will it take to recover, in your view? And in the interim, is it possible for the government to make up that lack of a powerful driver, a growth driver? Could that be made up for in industrial policy, do you think?
Very good question. So if we look at the property sector themselves, on one hand is that the transaction volume, including both the primary market and the secondary market, may recover earlier. Currently, we see actually the secondary market account for around like almost close to like 50% of total transaction in China, which is significantly increased from like 20% several years ago. And the second is, but a key issue is that the primary market sales is the main contribution to creates a main contribution to the GDP growth. So regarding to the primary market sales, we still see a very long way to go. Especially the price in the primary market, we still see some like downward pressure, both in this year and going forward.
It's a little surprising to see the stock prices of some of the banks have actually not been too bad. ICBC, for instance, over the last 6-7 months has trended higher. I'm wondering whether or not investors were hoping for an increase in dividend, but given the climate, is it not very reasonable to expect an increase in dividends?
Very good question. So actually, we do expect a dividend increase for some joint stock banks whose dividend payout was less than 30% before. And also for like CMB, they also increased their dividend payout ratio to from 30 to 35%. But for large SOE banks, as you just mentioned, we don't expect that they would increase their dividend payout because they need to balance between the loan growth, the asset growth, versus the core Tier 1 capital adequacy ratio. Mm. You know that the loan growth last year for SOE banks was like more than 13%.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely they need to pay attention to that.
All right, Chen Shujin, 谢谢你. Thank you very much for coming into our studios. From Jefferies with us live, this is Bloomberg.
This has been the Bloomberg Daybreak Asia podcast, bringing you the stories making news and moving markets in the Asia Pacific. Visit the Bloomberg podcast channel on YouTube to get more episodes of this and other shows from Bloomberg. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business app.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.